She was a real woman, a good girl, and more famous than me. Three things I'd never experienced on a date before. I was nervous as shit beforehand. I primped myself in the mirror for hours, popping zits, combing my hair, fussing with my shirt collar, dabbing cologne strategically around my body, and making sure all my tattoos were covered. I arrived early at the house where she lived with her sister, and dawdled outside until it was exactly 7 o'clock. I felt like a fucking trained monkey in my stiff white button-down shirt and black pants. I buzzed the doorbell, fidgeting nervously, and a girl who looked just like Heather opened the door. I didn't know what to say because I wasn't sure if it was Heather or her sister. I waved sheepishly, walked inside, and waited for her to give some sort of sign betraying her identity. Then, at the top of the staircase, I saw a white dress. Now, that was Heather. She descended slowly, without a word, like in Gone with the Wind. She looked so fucking hot that I wanted to run up to her, tackle her, and tear her clothes off. "You look beautiful," I told her as I gently took her arm. Her sister watched me carefully, and I could feel her sizing me up, determining whether I was right for Heather or just a clown. We went out for Italian food, then watched some lame stand-up comedy because I thought it was something that normal people did on dates. That night, we talked about everything. She had gone out with a lot of uptight rich guys and cheesy actors like Scott Baio, but she'd never been with a rocker. I could tell this was a point in my favor after she asked to see my tattoos. She was a good girl who fantasized about a bad boy, and I knew that even my starched collar and Dracar Noir cologne couldn't cover up the fact that I was that bad boy. We went back to her house and drank champagne, but I was too scared to make a move. I didn't want her to think I was just after a one-night stand or trying to mack on a famous actress. By the time I left that night, we had made a million plans together. We slowly started hanging out more, going to dinner, movies, parties. Eventually, I started spending the night at her house, but she would not put out, dude. I'd get her drunk and try to mack on her every way I could for weeks, but she wouldn't go all the way. That was another thing I had never experienced before, and because of it, we actually grew intimate and became friends. She had a bubbly personality, a great sense of humor, and loved playing pranks as much as I did. She showered me with flowers, and I learned to love it. Any guy, I decided, who says he doesn't like flowers is insecure about his masculinity. After a month and a half, I was so worked up, I couldn't take it anymore. We finally fucked, and she had made me wait so long that I savored every second because, believe me, it only lasted for seconds. But we did it again and again that night until we were sure we were in love, because when you're with someone you don't love, once is usually enough. The next morning, I was hanging out by her pool in my boxers when her father stopped by the house. Heather flipped out. She may have been famous for playing the sexually aggressive, domineering bitch on television, but in real life, she was as prude as they came. She was so worried her dad, who was the dean of the UCLA School of Engineering, would disapprove if he saw all my tattoos. I covered myself with towels, but even though there was ink peeking through, her dad didn't seem to mind. After we fucked, the relationship flew to a whole new level. One day, we were watching dirt bike racing on TV, and I told her I'd love to try that. The next day, there was a dirt bike outside my house. No one, male or female, had ever done anything that generous for me before. We were slowly realizing that we wanted to be together for a long, long time, maybe even forever. When I left her to tour a theater of pain, playing Home Sweet Home every night, I felt alarm bells going off in my head. That was what I wanted my whole life. I wanted to make a home, like my parents. I was always the gangly tag-along, running around L.A. looking for a father or mother figure. Maybe it came from the fear that my dream analyst said I picked up from my mother. I was scared of being alone, of being out of communication. The longer the theater tour dragged on, the more I knew what I wanted to do. When I was home on break during Christmas, Heather and I were driving on the Ventura Freeway in a limousine. I stood up and stuck my head through the moonroof. "Hey," I yelled to Heather. "Get up here and check this out." "What?" "Come up here."
Do I have to?
Slowly, reluctantly, she stood up. As soon as her head popped through the opening and her body pressed against mine, I asked her, "Will you marry me?"
"What?"
she said.
"It's too loud up here. I can't hear you."
"Will you marry me?"
"Really?"
She looked at me skeptically. I reached in my pocket and pulled out a diamond ring. "Really?"
"What?"
"Really?" When the tour ended, we married in a courtyard in Santa Barbara. I wore a white leather tuxedo, and she wore a white strapless dress with white sleeves that started midway down her arm, leaving her tan shoulders and thin, delicate neck bone uncovered. It was the biggest wedding I had ever seen. 500 guests. Skydivers dropping in carrying big magnums of champagne, and white doves that flew through the air after we said our vows. Rudy, one of our techs, gave us the best toast ever. "To Tommy and Heather," he said, raising a champagne glass. "May all your ups and downs be in bed." Then he took the champagne glass and smashed it over his head. I glanced at the tables where Heather's family was sitting, and they all looked like they were having second thoughts about the marriage. It was one of the happiest days of my life. All my friends were there, including half of the Sunset Strip scene. It seemed like everybody was in big bands now. Rat, Quiet Riot, Autograph, Night Ranger. The only problem that afternoon was Nicky. I asked him to be my best man, and he showed up a mess. He was emaciated. He sweated constantly, and his skin was pure yellow, dude. He kept excusing himself to go to the bathroom, and then he'd return and start nodding off in the middle of the ceremony. As a best man, he was so fucked up on heroin he was useless. I couldn't believe he was shooting up at my fucking wedding.
Chapter 2 Nicky. Recollections of how a great love blossomed into betrothal, thanks in no small measure to a Minnesinger's use of the ancient trick of giving Nicky drugs. The day after I returned home from Tommy's wedding, there was a hand-delivered letter from our accountant, Chuck Shapiro, waiting for me in the mailbox. "You have been spending $5,000 a day," he wrote. "$5,000 times 7 is $35,000 a week. Per month, that's $140,000. In exactly 11 months, you will be completely broke, if not dead." Before Tommy's wedding, I had managed to keep my habit a secret because I hardly saw anyone in the band. The gang was now split into different houses in different parts of the city. We were still doing pretty much the same thing we did when we all lived in an apartment together, waking up, getting fucked up, then going to sleep and starting all over again. But the difference was that we weren't doing it with each other. Tommy was in Heatherland, living in a multi-million dollar home in a private neighborhood with security gates. He was so excited that one of his neighbors was an investment banker making $45 million a year, and another was a lawyer handling major murder cases. But all I could think was, these people used to be our enemies. Vince was either in jail or hanging out at his house with strip club owners and sports dudes and sleazy businessmen. And as for Mick, he's so secretive, he could have been dealing arms to Iran or runway modeling for all I knew. A band's strength is in the solidarity of its members. When they split off into different worlds, that's usually when the problems and rifts begin that lead to a breakup. What was cool about us initially was that Vince and Tommy were kids from Covina. I was from Idaho, and Mick was from Indiana. We were all small-town, dysfunctional losers who somehow became rock stars. We made our dreams into our reality. But we got so caught up in success that we forgot who we were. Vince was trying to be Hugh Hefner. Tommy thought he was Princess Diana with his high-class marriage and new friends, and I thought I was some kind of glamorous bohemian junkie like William Burroughs or Jim Carroll. I guess Mick always wanted to be Robert Johnson or Jimi Hendrix, though he was drinking so much he was beginning to look more like Meatloaf. Reality came crashing down on me at Tommy's wedding. I was trying to kick, unsuccessfully, and was making an ass of myself because I had no social skills and didn't enjoy dancing with millionaires. During the reception, I told our tour manager, Rich Fisher, that I'd been doing a little bit of heroin, as if it wasn't obvious. And he told everyone in the management office. When I didn't respond to Chuck's warning letter, my management company and a counselor named Bob Timmons, who had helped Vince try to get sober, burst into my house and pulled an intervention. At first, I was pissed, but after talking for hours, they wore me down. Nicole and I agreed to check into rehab. The place was actually the same clinic on Van Nuys Boulevard where Vince had been. Like Vince, I wasn't ready for rehab, but unlike Vince, I didn't have the threat of prison to keep me there. During my third day, a fat, wart-faced woman kept trying to convince me that to clean up, I had to believe in a higher power. "Fuck you and fuck God," I finally yelled at her. I stormed out of the room, and she chased after me. I wheeled around, spit in her face, and told her to fuck off again. This time, she did. I went to my room, grabbed my guitar, jumped out of the second-story window, and started walking down Van Nuys Boulevard in my hospital gown. I lived 5 miles away. I figured I could make it. The hospital called Bob Timmons and told him I had escaped. He hopped into his car and caught up with me on Van Nuys Boulevard. "Nicky, get in the car," he said as he pulled up alongside me. "Fuck you." "Nicky, it's okay. Just get in the car. We're not mad at you." "Fuck you. I'm not going back to that place." "I won't take you back there. I promise." "You know what? Fuck you. I'm never going back there. Those people are insane. They're trying to brainwash me with God and all this shit." "Nicky, I'm on your side. I'll give you a ride home, and we can find a better way for you to get clean." I relented and accepted the ride. We drove back to my house and threw away all the needles, spoons, and drug residue. I begged him to help me get clean on my own, without God. Then I called my grandparents for support, because whatever little sanity I possessed as an adult was due to them. But my grandmother was too ill to take the call. That night, I wrote "Dancing on Glass," flashing back to my overdose with the line, "Valentine's in London found me in the trash." Nicole stayed in rehab for 2 more weeks. When she returned to the house as an outpatient afterward, something was different. We were sober. And being sober, we discovered that we didn't really like each other that much. With the heroin gone, we had nothing in common. We broke up immediately. To stay clean, I hired a live-in personal assistant named Jesse James, who was a 6'5" version of Keith Richards, and who always wore an SS hat covering up what I believe was a hairpiece. But over time, his job metamorphosed from babysitter to partner in crime. He went out and fetched me drugs, and as a reward, he got to do them with me. We drank and shot up coke, mostly. But every now and then, I'd inject a little heroin, for old time's sake. With Nicole gone, I started going through girls like socks. Jesse and I would sit around and watch TV all day. I'd try to write some songs for the next album, and when that failed, we'd call whatever Hollywood girl we wanted to fuck that night. But once we did all the strippers and porn stars we were interested in, we quickly became bored. We'd ride around the neighborhood and throw bricks through windows. But the fun wore off pretty quickly. I decided I needed a girlfriend. So we started picking out girls on television we wanted to go out with, imagining all kinds of funny dating scenarios. There was a cute blonde local newscaster we'd watch, and I'd call her at the station during a commercial break and talk dirty to her. Then I'd watch her when she went back on the air to see if she looked aroused or flustered or upset. Though she never came over, for some reason she always took our calls. One day, the video for Vanity 6's Nasty Girl came on the air, in which the three girls in the band rubbed themselves suggestively as they sang. As a protege of Prince's, the band's leader, Vanity, seemed to come from such a different world than mine. "It would kind of be cool to fuck her," I told Jesse. "Go for it, cowboy," he told me. I called our management office and told them I wanted to meet Vanity. They called her managers, and within a week I was on my way to her apartment in Beverly Hills for our first date. The second she opened the door, she fixed me with a crazy stare. Her eyes seemed like they were about to whirl out of her skull, and I knew before she even spoke a word that she was completely psychotic. But then again, so was I. She invited me into her apartment, which was only a few rooms cluttered with trash and clothes and artwork. Her house was full of weird poster boards with magazine clippings, egg cartons, and dead leaves glued to them. She called these things her artwork, and each one had a story. This one I call the Redeemer, she said, pointing out one messy collage. It depicts the prophecy of the angel descending on the city, for he will come to redeem the souls trapped in the bulbs of street lamps, and the little piggies will walk down the street and the children will laugh. That night, we never left the apartment. After all the girls I had corrupted, it was time for one to corrupt me. The artwork, she eventually admitted, was something she did after staying up for days freebasing cocaine. Freebasing? I asked. I've never really done that the right way before. And so I fell right into the spider's web. Stuck on freebase, I lost what little remained of the self-control I had been practicing since rehab and became a completely dysfunctional paranoid. One afternoon, there were some people hanging out in my living room, and Vanity and I were holed up in the bedroom. We turned on the radio, which was attached to speakers throughout the house, and listened to music while we lit up some freebase. As we were smoking, the music stopped and a talk radio program began. I pulled out my .357 Magnum and took another hit. As I was holding the freebase in my lungs, I yelled at the radio, "You motherfuckers! I'll fucking shoot you! Get the fuck out of here!" I think I somehow thought that the voices coming from the radio were actually the people in my living room, which was on the other side of the door. The voices didn't stop when I yelled at them, of course. So as I exhaled a sweet puff of white smoke into the air, I unloaded my .357 through the door. But the voices continued. "I'll fucking kill you! I'll fucking kill you!" I yelled at them. I kicked open the door and saw that they were coming from a 4-foot-tall speaker in the corner. I loaded another clip into the gun and littered the speaker with .357 hollow-point magnum shells. It fell on its side. But the voices continued. "Hi, this is KLOS, and you're talking to Doug." I fucking flipped out, and everybody cleared out of my living room while I tore the poor speaker apart until eventually the voices stopped. I think Vanity must have, in a moment of lucidity, figured out how to turn off the radio. Our relationship was one of the strangest, most self-destructive ones I've ever had. We would binge together for a week, and then not see each other for 3 weeks. Or, while smoking crack, she would lecture me about how drinking Coca-Cola was bad for my stomach lining. One afternoon, when I was at her house, a dozen roses from Prince arrived with a note saying, "Drop 'em, take me back." At the time, I fell for it, but now I think she was just manipulating me. Prince probably never sent her any flowers. Other times, I'd be at her apartment, and she'd send me out for orange juice. When I returned, the security guard wouldn't let me back in. "But I was just here," I'd say, completely confused. "Sorry, sir, direct orders. You can't come in." "What the—" If I were you, I would just split anyway. I don't know what all goes on in that apartment, but I don't ever want to know. One of her neighbors eventually told me that she'd have a dealer waiting around the corner who would bring her bricks of coke to cook up as soon as I left. She'd hide it from me not because she was embarrassed about the extent of her habit, but because she was worried I'd smoke it all. One night, Vanity asked me to marry her. I said yes, just because I was fucked up. The idea was surreal, and it was easier than saying no. The relationship was just about drugs and entertainment, not love or sex or even friendship. But when she was fucked up in an interview, she told the press we were engaged. She always found a way to make my life as difficult as possible. Tommy was in his multi-million-dollar Hollywood home, and here I was stuck in Rock City. No wonder it always felt like he was looking down on us, because we deserved it. While I was dating Vanity, our manager started trying to put the band back into communication to record an album. By that time, I was not only freebasing, I was strung out on heroin again. I wore cowboy boots on the outside of tight pants, and the sides of the boots were constantly stuffed full of syringes and lumps of tar. I didn't want to be shooting up anymore, and I put a lot of effort into trying to get straight. But I couldn't help it. When I decided to go on methadone to withdraw, it only made matters worse, and soon I was hooked on both heroin and methadone. Every morning before I went to the studio, I'd drive to the methadone clinic in my brand new Corvette and stand in line with all the other junkies to get my fix. Then I'd drive to the studio and spend half of each day taking bathroom breaks. Sometimes Vanity would stop by and embarrass me by lecturing the band on the dangers of carbonated beverages and burning incense that smelled like horse shit. Lita Ford was working on a record in the studio next door, and when she saw me, she couldn't believe how I'd deteriorated. "You used to be ready to take on the world," she told me, "but now you look as if you let the world take you down." And though I couldn't seem to write a song for the Motley record, I managed to write a song with her for her album, appropriately titled Falling In and Out of Love. As we were getting nowhere slowly on our record, my grandfather and Aunt Sharon kept calling. My grandmother was getting sicker, and they wanted me to come visit her. But I was so smacked out, I kept ignoring the calls until it was too late. My grandfather called crying one afternoon and gave me directions to her funeral, which was to take place the following Saturday. I promised him that I would be there. When Saturday rolled around, I had been awake for 2 days straight. I shot up some coke to give me enough energy to put one foot in front of the other, crawled off the sofa, started to dress, and fumbled around trying to find the directions for an hour. Then I changed my clothes 3 times, and puttered around looking for car keys and worrying about how I'd find the funeral home before I decided that it was too complicated and I just couldn't get my act together. I sat back down on my couch, cooked up some freebase, and turned on the TV. I sat there, knowing that as I watched Gilligan's Island, the rest of my family was at her funeral, and the guilt started to seep in. She was the woman who would put up with me when my mom couldn't, the woman who had dragged me across the country from Texas to Idaho like I was her own son. Without her willingness to take me in every time, whether she was living in a gas station or a hog farm, I probably never would have been sitting in a giant rock star house shooting up. I'd be doing it under a bridge in Seattle. The next day, I resolved to clean up so that I could write some music for the album and maybe even call my grandfather and beg him to forgive my self-centeredness. The first song I wrote was Nona, which was the name of my grandmother. Tom Zutaut stopped by the house and listened to it. "Nona, I'm out of my head without you," and tears welled up in his eyes. I often have nightmares about my grandmother's sickness and funeral, because not being there for her and my grandfather then is one of the things I regret most about my life. Tom wasn't working at Elektra anymore. He had moved to Geffen and had signed Guns N' Roses. He wanted me to produce their record and see if I could give the punk metal they were playing at the time a more commercial, melodic edge without sacrificing credibility. They were just a punk band, he told me, but they were capable of being the greatest rock and roll band in the world if someone could help them find the melodies to take them there. I was in too much agony trying to slow down my drug intake to consider the idea, but Tom's confidence motivated me to write for my own album. I bought an old Bernard Falk book from 1937 called 5 Years Dead, which inspired the song of the same name, and focused on kickstarting my brain. I knew my window of sobriety would be brief, so I had to work quickly. Like Theater of Pain, Girls, Girls, Girls could have been a phenomenal record, but we were too caught up in our own personal bullshit to put any effort into it. You could actually hear the distance that had grown between us in our performance. If we hadn't managed to force 2 songs out of ourselves, the title track and Wild Side, the album would have been the end of our careers. In the studio, we were each mixing our drugs with something we had never combined them with before: guilt, denial, and secrecy. And those 3 words are the difference between an addict and a hedonist. Tommy was in Heatherland, which wasn't just a land of paradise, but also of discipline, where he had to hide his drug use from her. Because of it, he was becoming a stressed-out wreck. Vince was trying to stay sober but failing miserably, distracting himself from his own unhappiness with girls and mud wrestling. And Mick was up to something behind our backs, though none of us had any idea what that was. In the months before we returned to the studio, we were so busy fighting our own demons that we completely forgot about Mick. When we saw him again, it looked like someone had sewn his head onto the body of a Samoan wrestler. His arms and neck were so bloated, we worried he wouldn't be able to reach his guitar frets. He always pretended like he was too old to party with us, that he had done his share of drugs as a teenager, but something was up, and he wasn't telling us what.
Part 7. Some of our best friends are drug dealers. Chapter 1. Mick. In which the former Bob Allen Deal recounts the hijinks of his youth eons ago when cowboys roamed the land and birth control had clearly not yet been invented. Back in my day, bailing rope wasn't made out of wire. It was real rope, about a quarter inch wide if you laid it out flat. It was closer to twine, really, and we used it to bale the hay. I guess we also used it to hang my older brother. My younger brother, Tim, and I made a 1.5-foot loop in the baling rope and held it together with a slip knot. I threw the loop over the branch of an oak tree and tied the other end of the rope around the trunk. Tim found a 5-gallon drum in my grandmother's shed and placed it under the hanging noose. Then we made our older brother, Frank, stand on the drum, slipped the noose around his neck, and made sure it was good and tight. I kicked the drum out from under him, and we watched him swing. We were the Indians. He was the cowboy. He screamed and struggled as he dangled in the air, and he kept grabbing at the noose with his hands trying to loosen it. When we grew bored of running around him, whooping and hollering, Tim and I headed inside. "Where's Frank?" Aunt Thelma asked. Aunt Thelma, who couldn't have been more than 5 feet tall, was my grandmother's most loyal daughter and lived with her until finally marrying at the age of 55. "Out there," Tim pointed to the side yard. "Oh, my word," Aunt Thelma gasped, and she ran out to the tree, lifted Frank up, and pulled the noose off his neck. I was 5 years old, and I wasn't messing around. I was born B.A.D. Bob Allen Deal. People who have had near-death experiences always say they enter a tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel there is a light. I like to think that when you die, you go through the tunnel, and when you get to the other end, you are reborn. The tunnel is the birth canal, and the light at the end of the tunnel is the hospital maternity ward, where your new life awaits you. When someone has a near-death experience where they see the light but don't walk into it, there is a woman somewhere delivering a stillborn baby who was supposed to have that person's soul. I used to tell people that in a past life I was Buddy Holly. Then I came back as Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, and finally I returned to Earth as Mick Mars. But I was never serious. That doesn't mean I've ruled out the possibility of a past life, but I do wonder why people always believe they were a famous or historical figure. What happened to the chimney sweeps and beggars and housewives? Didn't they get reincarnated too? As for me, I was informed of my past lives by a wise old hippie burnout known as the Midnight Gardener, who used to come to my house in the Santa Monica Mountains and tend to my lawn every night at 1 a.m. The Midnight Gardener told me that I had been the king of Borneo, a cannibal, and a slave who worked on the Great Pyramids of Egypt. I think I must have been some sort of womanizer and thief, because in this life, I'm being punished for it. Women and money don't like me. In fact, the former always seemed to walk out of my life with all the latter. From the time I hanged my brother, I knew what I wanted to do with this life. Because later that week, Aunt Thelma took Frank, Tim, and me to the 4-H Fair in Hyers Park in Huntington, Indiana, where we lived. She bought us popsicles, and we sat down in the grass to eat them and watch a concert. I was so young, I didn't even know what a concert was. I saw a tall, skinny guy in a bright orange rhinestone cowboy suit and a white hat, much fancier than the cowboy outfit Frank had worn when I lynched him. The man on the stage introduced himself as Skeeter Bond, and he started singing. There were other cowboys playing guitar and drums behind him, making a lot of noise. My jaw dropped open, and I completely forgot about my popsicle, which melted all over my clothes. I wanted to be him. I wanted to make music on a stage. I didn't care what kind of music, really. Music was music. It was all great, whether it was Skeeter Bond, cowboy music, or my mom's Elvis Presley records. That Christmas, my brothers and I ran downstairs in the morning to open our presents. There were long stockings hanging over the fireplace, and one of them had a tiny guitar strung with what were probably rubber bands. "That's mine," I yelled, and I grabbed it before anyone could take it from me. The following Christmas, when I was 6, my mother bought me a Mickey Mouse guitar, which had mouse ears on the head and a little crank that I could turn to make it play Mouseketeer songs. but I wasn't interested in Mouseketeer songs. I learned how to tighten the strings so that it sounded more like Skeeter Bond's twangy guitar and figured out how to play actual melodies on it. There was a cool loafer in his 20s who lived nearby, and I called him Sundance. He had an old guitar named Blue Moon, and he taught me my first real song on Blue Moon. My dog has fleas. Sometimes I wonder whether country music was my real calling. Eventually, Sundance taught me how to pick melodies, like the murder ballad, Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley. I liked the melodies because they jumped out of Blue Moon, and though I didn't know the terminology at the time, I was already favoring lead guitar over rhythm, which seemed more like something that was played in the background. If it wasn't for Jesus being born, I never would have gotten anywhere in music, because it was on another Christmas, a few years later, that my oldest cousin bought me a Stella guitar that he had found in a pawn shop for $12. Soon afterward, my parents gave birth to their first girl, Susan, or Bird, as we called her. Bird was born with a collapsed lung, and in order to increase her chance of survival, her doctors suggested that we move to a more arid climate like Arizona or California. So 10 of us, me, my brothers, my parents, my sister, my aunt, my uncle, and my cousins, crunched into a 1959 Ford. After 3.5 days of stiff backs and oxygen deprivation, we arrived in Garden Grove, California. It was like the Grapes of Wrath, only California actually lived up to the fantasy. There were orange trees everywhere, and at night, we could see the fireworks going off above Disneyland. But in California, country music and Skeeter Bond were foreign words. Surf music was what was happening. Dick Dale, The Ventures, The Surfaris. My father worked at Menasha Container, which made cardboard boxes for one of my favorite companies, Fender, and my mother ironed shirts on weekends for extra money. $2 a day if she was lucky. Though I had another younger brother and a sister by then, she still saved up enough to buy me a $49 St. George electric guitar. Now I could make surf music that sounded like curling and crashing waves, just like Dick Dale played it. Volume was also important to me, but my parents didn't have enough money to buy me an amplifier or a stereo. Instead, I took my little sister's phonograph speaker, removed the wires from the tone arm, and made my own combination amp and stereo so that I could play along with my favorite surf songs. My father, in the meantime, woke up one day and suddenly decided to become a Baptist minister. When he was a child, he had suffered from a crippling disease that attacked his legs. The doctors said there was nothing they could do for him except pray for mercy from God. When the disease cleared up, it must have planted a God trigger in my dad's mind, which fired that morning when he came running into the kitchen raving that he had seen the error of his ways and wanted to dedicate his life to a ministry. Despite finding religion, my father never tried to discourage me from making music. He and my mother thought that the reason I was so obsessed was that my brain had been fried when I was 3. I came down with scarlet fever and ran a 106-degree temperature for 3 days. A doctor came to my grandmother's house, where I was in bed almost dead, and took off all my clothes, covered me with cold towels, and packed my bed with ice. Then he opened up every door and window in the house until the winter air filled the room, and after an hour, the fever broke. I was so sick, they said, that maybe I never recovered. Surf music to them was just another disease. But soon after came an even more infectious disease, the Beatles. Overnight, surf rock was archaic and pop with vocals, melodies, harmonies, and lyrics you could nod your head to was in. I decided that I had to sing, too. I practiced every day for a year until I was ready to show my family. I gathered them downstairs and sang Money by the Beatles. The cousin who had bought me my first real guitar went into a fit of hysterics. He said I wouldn't be able to carry a tune if he wrapped it up and put handles on it. I was so embarrassed that I never tried to sing again, for the rest of my life. At 14, I joined my first band, the Jades, a Beatles cover group with a few originals that might as well have been Beatles songs. I started off on bass, but soon replaced their guitarist. Our first gig was at the American Legion Hall in Westminster, and we made $12 to split between the four of us. We were never asked back, however. Either we were too heavy or too terrible. I had a friend named Joe Abbey, a Samoan who had never given up on surf guitar and could play so well he'd bring you to your knees. I wanted to borrow his amp and reverb pedal, but he said they belonged to the Garcia brothers. He gave me their phone number, and that's where it really began. I walked into their house and found three of them, Tony, Johnny, and Paulie. They were big and mean and led a street gang called the Garcia brothers. Tony was a guitar player who would have his brothers beat up anyone who said they were better than him. Paulie was a tall drummer who was unhappy because he felt like he should be playing guitar. And Johnny was a bass player who had been put in youth authority when he was 16 for beating up two cops. They also played with a non-brother, Paul, a blind harmonica player who looked like Jesus. They were tough, and they didn't play surf rock or the Beatles. They played the blues. Hard, electric blues. Their neighbors hated them because they knew the brothers were doing drugs and fighting. For some reason, there were always blind, deaf, or handicapped people hanging around the brothers, and I figured it was evidence that they either had a soft, compassionate side or were running some kind of mysterious scam. At 9 p.m. one night, the cops arrested us all because of noise complaints, and I received what they called summer probation, basically just for playing my guitar. That may be why I now have a pet peeve against neighbors who make noise complaints. We formed a band, pretentiously, called Sounds of Soul, and played at underage clubs around Orange County, like the Sandbox. At school, I didn't care about anything except for music. I was one of the three best guitarists there. The best was Chuck Frayer, who could solo like nobody I'd seen before, bending notes and letting them hang in the air forever. He ended up getting drafted into the Marines during Vietnam, and the last time I saw him was on The Gong Show. He was playing the harmonica in a suit that made it look like he had two heads. And you can bet your mother's horse race winnings that he got gonged. The other great guitarist was Larry Hansen, who ended up with the Gatlin Brothers. And the third was me. School was pure torture, and all I could think about was getting home to practice. In English, our teacher, Mr. Hickok, wanted us to write an essay on a poem. All the other kids wrote about Robert Frost and Ralph Waldo Emerson, but I came in with Pressed Rat and Warthog by Cream. When Mr. Hickok returned the papers, he had written on mine, F, which is a big understatement. The next day, we had a test, and I answered one question by calling the teacher a square, music-hating snob, writing, which is a big understatement, beneath it. I handed in the paper, and when he read it, he sent me to the principal, who suspended me, which was a big understatement, he said, because I should have been expelled. I didn't care. I only wanted to be taught by people who knew something about music. But now I wish I had paid more attention in English classes, because when I talk to people, I worry that I sound uneducated or use the wrong words. When I returned to school, a substitute teacher in my science class kicked me out for writing guitar chord charts in my notebook instead of paying attention. As I walked out of the classroom, I turned back to him and yelled, "I know where you park your car. I know where you live. You better watch your back." I didn't think I was that intimidating a guy. I looked like a red-haired Dwayne Allman with a peach fuzz mustache. But the teacher got so freaked out, he sent the cops to my home. By then, I was living in a little garden shed behind my parents' house, which sat alongside a creek. It was a place where I could play my guitar at any hour, stay up as late as I wanted, and let friends crash and drink some vino. When the cops saw the place, they said it wasn't fit for a dog to live in. They lectured my parents, and though I was allowed to return to school, I guess I just stopped going after that. If school back then was like the ones they have today, with art classes, music appreciation, and computers, I would have stayed. But there was nothing there that interested me back then. I never paid much attention to girls. I met my first love at the Garcia brothers' house. She was 14, and some of the younger Garcia brothers, there had to have been at least a dozen Garcia brothers running around, brought her home from junior high. We started hanging out, and I figured that we were dating after a while. One night, I asked her to go out, and she said her parents were making her stay home with them. So I went bowling with Joe Abbey instead, and she walked into the bowling alley with another boy. I was devastated. I asked her what she was doing out, and she slurred something because she was drunk. As I felt my testosterone flow into my heart, making my blood burn, my friends dragged me out of the bowling alley and drove me off in their car. I gave up on women that day. All thoughts of girls, dating, and getting laid went down the chute, allowing me to spend even more time practicing. For Christmas that year, my Aunt Annie, who always believed in me, even when friends and family didn't, had bought me a beat-to-shit Les Paul for $98. Then in May, a kid gave me a 1954 Stratocaster when he graduated because he never played it. By that time, I was no longer one of the three best guitarists in my age range. I was the best. I soon stopped playing with the Garcia brothers. It had gotten too scary. Gang activities kept overlapping with band activities, and rival gangs were always coming over to start fights. One of the Garcia brothers later landed in jail after accidentally killing a little girl in a drive-by shooting, and another ended up playing in Richard Marx's band. I told you they were bad. The brothers used to work with a singer named Antone, who was probably one of the greatest black belters I'd ever heard. He tipped me off to a blues band in Fresno he was working with that needed a guitarist. So I packed up my two guitars, borrowed a reverb box from a friend, and they picked me up and brought me to Fresno. It was exciting at first because they were an all-black band and they wanted me to teach them about rhythm and soul. I sat down with them all day and showed them everything I knew, and at night I slept on a pool table in their clubhouse. But they became frustrated when they didn't sound like John Lee Hooker after a week, though I kept telling them that keeping cool and relaxed and patient is part of where soul comes from. As I was teaching them a blues scale on the porch, an old black guy drove up in a 1960 Cadillac with a ratty acoustic guitar in the seat. He was so big that his arms practically dragged on the ground when he opened the door and walked out. "That's the blues," I told the guys in the band. "You are living the blues." But they just couldn't play it, no matter how badly they wanted to. I was so let down, and I felt too old to be wasting my time like this. I guess I always felt like I was too old, even at 17. I had gone to Fresno with no cash, assuming that we'd soon be making money from our gigs. But there were no gigs, and I was broke. So I borrowed $10 from the drummer for food. After a few days, all I was hearing was, "You owe me $10. They were getting lessons for free, and all they could think about was money and greed. I picked watermelons in my spare time to earn extra change for food, but I didn't make enough to repay my debt. So the band ended before it even began. They drove me home, only so that they could hit up my Aunt Thelma for $10 when she answered the door. Greed is usually the greatest obstacle to success, right after selfishness. I was later able to repay Aunt Thelma, who went on to become Motley Crue's biggest fan. She saved every news clipping, subscribed to every metal magazine, and, despite being partially deaf, went to every concert she could. When her husband died, however, she disappeared. I eventually found her living in a house with no heat, no plumbing, no carpet, peeling paint, and a collapsed roof. I sent her money to fix up the place, and every time I saw her afterward, I'd slip her a few hundred for gas and water bills. She would always tell me that she couldn't understand how anybody could have as much money as I had given her. Like my father, she never lost some of the innocence of childhood. When I returned home after Fresno, my friend Ron was living in the shed behind my parents' house. I really had it rigged up by then. I had a black light, which shone on red and green psychedelic posters on the walls. I had a TV, which I had found discarded on a street corner, and I still used the homemade stereo I had made so long ago out of my sister's phonograph. Ron and I loved crosstops, which were basically trucker speed, that you could buy in packs of 100 for $10 at any pharmacy. We'd swallow fistfuls and hitchhike as far away as we could get, then return home from Whittier or wherever we were when the speed wore off at dawn. After speed, I started getting into Seconal, which was a heavy painkiller that I'd washed down with slow gin. I got so strung out that my doctor told me I'd die if I didn't quit. So I stopped cold, which was the stupidest thing I could do because going cold turkey on painkillers like that could have put me into a coma. When you get older, you worry about death and your own mortality a lot more than when you're younger. However, with cloning, which I'm sure has already been done with humans in secret, we're just one step away from scientific resurrection for the chosen ones. That is, the rich. I never really got into psychedelics. While I was hitchhiking, someone I met offered me a tab of mescaline. I took about half the tablet, which was the size of a Rolaid. When nothing happened, I took the other half. And then it hit me like a billy club. I was fucked up for 3 days. I was seeing people shrink and walk through walls and float into the air, and nothing made sense. All I could think was, when am I going to come down? I tried some orange microdot acid once, and the same thing happened. I was running so wild and getting so many dirty looks from my family that I figured it was time to find my own place. I didn't have any money, so I moved in with some bikers in Orange County. It was like being with the Garcia brothers again, because I was far too scrawny and innocent. When they spilled beer on the floor, they'd pick me up and use my long hair as a mop. They didn't want to get their Levi's dirty, they'd explain. And I wouldn't argue. They all packed guns, because other bike clubs would steal their motorcycles, file down the numbers, and keep or sell them. Nowadays, I have a good radar for trouble. I've been through it. When I see it coming, I duck, because I know what happens when it hits you. But back then, my trouble radar wasn't in operation. So I didn't duck when a friend of mine named Mike Collins brought his ex-girlfriend, Sharon, to a party we were having. She was an earthy 5'2" brunette with auburn coloring in her hair and a face like Ally McGraw. We started dating right away, but she was much more serious than me. Her mother and father had broken up when she was young, and even though she was only 16, she craved the security that she had lacked in her childhood. Though she was after marriage from day one, I knew that I couldn't be a husband. I wanted to be a guitarist, and that was it. I was only 19 and had no plans of getting a job or settling down in any way whatsoever. I knew it would take a while to make it in rock and roll, and I was prepared to put in the time. Nonetheless, she came home from work one evening, and with a vague smile on her face, broke the news to me. "I'm pregnant." "No," I told her. "I'm not stopping. This is what I want to do." She said she was keeping the baby, and she found me a job at the laundromat where she worked at the time. I was playing after-hours clubs with a band called Watoshi, which we thought meant number one in Chinese. We'd play until 6 a.m., then I'd sleep for 2 hours, go to the laundromat at 8 a.m., and work until it was time to play music again. A few months after my son, Les Paul, guess who named him, was born, Sharon was pregnant again. My dream couldn't have seemed any further away. I was stuck in everything I had spent my whole life trying to avoid. A wife, 2 kids, a regular guy job at a ridiculous laundromat. All this responsibility was coming down on me when I wasn't ready for it, and I couldn't bear the weight. I started having horrendous hot flashes. All of a sudden, my body would grow feverish, and I'd slip into another world that looked and felt a lot like hell. Other times, I'd black out for hours at a time. I'd wake up in bed or on stage or in the street and have no idea how I got there. I was going through some sort of transformation. Either I was going insane, or I was in some sort of strange mental cocoon that was part of the process of changing from a boy to a man. I didn't know which way to turn. I couldn't abandon my wife when she was pregnant, and I sure as heck wasn't going to give up on becoming a great blues or rock and roll guitarist. So I turned to the only person who I thought could help. God. I began talking with him, praying, asking for mercy and help and guidance. I may not know how we got here. We may be rejects from alien societies, or we may just be some master race's experiment in a petri dish called the world, but someone or something started this whole thing in motion. And at that time, I had to believe it was God. Because if I couldn't believe in God, I couldn't believe in anything. And if I couldn't believe in anything, what was the point in going on with my life? In the midst of this, a friend of my father's happened to stop by. He was an older deacon who had grown a beard to appear sophisticated, though it only served to make him look even older. The only thing worse is beards on bald men, because they make them look like they have their hair on upside down. The deacon quickly perceived that I was on the verge of a serious nervous breakdown. "Do you want to get baptized?" he asked, rubbing his old gray beard. I told him that yes, I did. He brought me to his church and stood me in 3 feet of water. "I baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit," he recited as he held my nose and dunked me backward into the water. "I hope this helps," I thought to myself, as I emerged baptized. Nowadays, I don't believe in the Christian concept of a God who created people for the sole purpose of judging and punishing them. After all, if one of the commandments is, "Thou shalt not kill," does that make God a hypocrite when he does things like flooding the world or destroying Sodom and Gomorrah? But at the time, I needed the forgiveness. I needed someone to wash away my past and start me over again, fresh. It worked for a little while. I even formed a gospel band. But it was only a temporary relief, like Seconal. It killed the pain for a little while, but the pain came back with a new intensity. Every time I walked into church, I had a sick feeling inside that it wasn't where I was supposed to be, that maybe I was just even more trapped by normality. Now I had a wife, 2 children, a shitty job, and, on top of it all, weekly services and church events to attend. One afternoon, I was working at the laundromat, exhausted from lack of sleep, transferring a 600-pound tub of wet clothes from the washer to the dryer. The tub was attached to a hook that hung from a conveyor belt on the ceiling, kind of like in a meat processing plant. And as I swung the tub toward the dryer, I lost my grip, and it swung back and smashed my left hand. A flash of panic shot through my head. What if I could never play guitar again? I walked into the main office, had it bandaged, and left for the day. I never returned. And though my hand eventually healed, Watoshi replaced me during my absence. I told Sharon that I'd never work a day job again, and she turned so many different colors of anger and sickness and disgust that she looked like some kind of TV test pattern. She had gotten me a job at the laundromat, and now I was throwing it away. She was sick of playing mother and father at the same time, and it was clear that I was unable to do anything for myself. So, on Christmas, the day when everything seems to happen in my life, she took Les Paul and our 5-month-old daughter, Stormy, a girl who would make me a grandfather 3 times over before I hit 40, and left me. Now, on top of everything else, I had to make child support payments, $200 a month, and I wasn't making a penny with music. Broke and in debt, I begged my parents to let me move back into their house. They did, and there I was, right back in the shed where I had started. I had taken a long time to go nowhere. On top of everything, the cops came knocking on my shed again, just like in high school. But this time, they took me to jail for non-payment of child support. And I spent 2 nights trying to keep guys from fucking me in the ass and lighting my bunk on fire. Then, just when I thought I couldn't sink any lower, came the news that would knock me into a pit of hell for the rest of my life.
Chapter 2 Mick. A great secret is shared from which the discerning reader may come to find a deeper empathy for a silent hero, isolated on an unusual battlefield. I first noticed it when I was 19. My hips started hurting so bad every time I turned my body that it felt like someone was igniting fireworks in my bones. I didn't have enough money to see a doctor, so I just kept hoping that I could do what I usually do, will it away through the power of my mind. But it kept getting worse. When I was married to Sharon, she had encouraged me to see a doctor. He told me that I wasn't living right, and if I exercised, the pain would go away. I walked away $50 poorer. I knew the pain was a symptom of something other than just laziness. But I didn't know what. Was it the way I strapped on my guitar? Were all the crosstops and mini-thins somehow destroying my bones? Then, one afternoon while doing my laundry, I started having trouble breathing. At first, it felt like someone had plunged a knife into my back. But as the weeks passed, the pain kept moving around my back. Next, my stomach started burning, and I worried that my whole body was about to fall apart. I thought that there was a hole in my stomach and acids were leaking out and destroying my bones and organs. I'd grab hold of doorknobs, anchor my legs into the ground, and pull with my hands to stretch my back and ease the pressure on it. During gigs, I couldn't even pick up the Marshall head from the top of my stack anymore because my back hurt so bad I couldn't lift my arms over my shoulders. It felt like my spine had been replaced by a petrified cactus. When I returned home from jail, Aunt Thelma took me to see a back specialist, and that was when I first heard the two words that would make me a freak and misfit for the rest of my life. Ankylosing spondylitis. What struck me most about the diagnosis was that the disease contained the word losing. I had lost. Ankylosing spondylitis is a degenerative bone disease that I'm told is inherited, though I don't know of any relatives who have it. It usually affects the joints and ligaments that allow the spine to move, making them inflamed and stiff. It is as if hot, quick-drying cement is growing on the inside of your spine, becoming so heavy over the years that it starts to pull you down. People think that I walk hunched over because I'm shy, but it's because my spine is slowly forcing me down to the ground. The doctor said I had an extremely rare form of the disease that begins in the teenage years, but it would stop when I was in my mid-30s. But it still hasn't gotten any better, and I'm far past my 30s. Some people say that time cures all wounds, but I think that time is the wound. Until the doctors gave me painkillers, I used to eat 15 Advil at a time to stop the ache, but it was never enough. I had to be alert to play the guitar so I couldn't knock myself out like I needed. It became more urgent than ever to get my career on track before the disease set into the joints in my hand and robbed me of the only thing I cared about in this world, playing guitar. I started hitchhiking again. My friend Ron had gotten married, stuck in the life I was trying to avoid, so I drifted like a hobo with Mike Collins. Most weekends, Mike and I would hitchhike to nightclubs around Orange County, looking for good bands to jam with. At Pier 11, I found White Horse. They played cover songs like Free Ride and Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo, but they played them better than any band I had been in. When I heard they were thinking about getting rid of their guitar player, I started showing up for every single gig, arriving early and sticking around afterward, even though my back was so bad I couldn't help them pack up their equipment. After half a year of complete devotion, they finally said, "Okay, you got it. You got the gig." I moved out of my parents' shack and into a cockroach-infested apartment in Hollywood with the drummer and keyboard player in White Horse. I slept on the floor in my sleeping bag, which murdered my back, and built a wall of music equipment around myself to keep the roaches and rats from crawling on my face. I spent 7 years on and off playing with White Horse, and in that time the pain spread. First it fanned out to my knees, ankles, and wrists. Then it worked up to my shoulders and between my shoulder blades until every joint was hurting, and I could no longer sleep flat on my back or stomach. I had to start sleeping propped up in a half-sitting position. I tried to use my influence on White Horse to get them to play originals, but the guys were always chasing a quick buck. Finally, the singer told me that I should quit because the rest of the band was about to fire me. I decided to wait it out, and 2 days later the keyboardist cleaned house. He dumped the singer, the bass player, and me, and turned White Horse into a disco band. Because I couldn't afford rent, I was kicked out of the house as well, and went back to drifting again. Squats in North Hollywood, park benches, even my ex-sister-in-law's house. I found a job at a motorcycle factory, though I was often in so much pain that I was useless at work. And then one night, my new girlfriend, Marcia, who I had met after a White Horse show at Pier 11, came over with the vague smile that I had seen on another woman's face before, and broke the news to me that had been broken so many times before. I'm pregnant. Of course, she wanted to keep the baby. Life had gone full circle and dropped me back in the quicksand. It felt like my dream was slipping out of my hands again, though I was actually closer to it than I knew. I made the first step in the right direction by not getting married again. Then I drifted through bands like Vendetta, which included two ex-White Horse members, and moved to Alaska to make some quick money playing top 40 music. When I placed the ad in The Recycler that Tommy and Nikki responded to, I expected to find myself in just another cover band fighting over ego and money. But once Vince joined, I knew my search, almost 3 decades since I first saw Skeeter Bond, 3 decades of hitchhiking through bands, drugs, sofas, and relationships, was over. This was where I was supposed to be. But the more successful we became, the harder it was to enjoy the rewards. New ankylosing spondylitis symptoms kept appearing. Something called iritis set in, producing bolts of pain in my eyes whenever I looked into bright lights, like I did on stage every night. And my lower spine seized up and froze completely solid, causing scoliosis in my back and squashing me further down and forward until I was a full 3 inches shorter than I was in high school. That's why I never take off my platform boots. I don't want to be a pygmy. The disease finds any open spot between or inside bones, ribs, joints, ligaments, and grows there. If you try to operate and remove it, it just sprouts back like a cut-off fingernail. When I die, I figure my skeleton will be rock solid. If they display it in a medical class, they won't even need wires to hold it up. The worst part of the disease, however, isn't the pain or the slouching. It's walking on stage, seeing all the people out there excited, and not being able to do anything about it. So many times on stage I've wanted to walk down to the bass bins, but I know that if I make it there, there's no way I can get back on stage unless Vince or Nikki pull me back up. And if, God forbid, a fan dragged me into the audience, I'd be hospitalized. I get so upset every night watching the way that Nikki and Vince run all over the stage. All I can do is plod around and, when a fan in front starts cheering, muster a smile, say hey, or try to throw them a pick. I watched myself on film the other day and I looked like a statue whose hands have somehow come to life. When I tried to move, it looked so fucking stupid. It looks better if I just stand still.